Welcome, everyone. I'm glad that the elements did not keep you from coming this evening. And hopefully, as we go through the five sessions that this course involves, the weather will get better and easier for you to navigate to this place. I should explain briefly that this is designed to be a course at once theoretical and practical. The idea is to bring everyone up to date on what Marxian class analysis is, how it has evolved, like everything else, and changed over time, as have other theories, as has Marxism itself. And then most of the courses, the classes, excuse me, are going to be in how to apply it, how to use this kind of class analysis. And I will be working very hard to demonstrate to you the very different understandings of major events in our time that you get if you use class analysis in the Marxian way as compared to how other approaches and other kinds of analysis work, so that you can see very practically what the gains are from using a sophisticated Marxian analysis. So let me begin with a few introductions to set the tone for what I'm trying to do here. First, class, I would argue, the concept of class and class analysis is one of the most repressed discourses in our culture. It has a taboo attached to it. It's like discussing in the inappropriate group details of your sex life, or details of your personal interactions with your folks, or something like that. It is not done in large parts of our culture. No kind of sophisticated class analysis can be found in, say, the congressional record. Our elected representatives in neither house at the federal level, nor in any state house that I'm aware of, ever make use of the term. And as I'll show you a little bit later, on those few occasions when there is reference to class, it's a stereotypic caricature that is brought forward, not any kind of sophisticated argument. So part of the course in class analysis is, to use the categorical Freudian idea, a return of the repressed. It is bringing back into our language, into our frameworks of thought, a concept that has been at the forefront of thinking in the past, but has been repressed largely since the end of the Second World War for all kinds of historical and political reasons, and which is, by the way, coming back now. So in a sense, this course helps you to understand a way of thinking that you're going to be seeing and hearing more and more in the years ahead. The second thing I need to focus you on is that the concept of class, when you actually hear it, and we do hear it from time to time, means very different things to different people. So we have a very peculiar situation here with class analysis, in that the same word means radically different things to different people, and that there's no way around having to deal with that. And one of the things we're going to do today is go through with you some of the fundamentally different ways this concept is working today and has worked historically since it's been around a long time. And that has to be done so that you are not confused, misled, when you hear the term class, as you will more and more, because you think everybody who's using the term means the same thing when they don't. Okay, so let's begin. First, the simplest way to begin is to look at the word itself, class. What does it mean to talk about a class? What is it? Well, the word class comes from a verb, and the verb is to classify. So all that really class means is you're taking a group of something and breaking it down into subgroups. The subgroups are classes. So for example, among the things called living things, we break them, modern thought does, into two groups, plants and animals. We classify, that is, we subgroup all living things into the plants and the animals. There are people who use the term the class of animals as opposed to the class of plants. And that's a perfectly reasonable thing because you're classifying, you're breaking down. So the first meaning of the word class at the most general level is breaking down something, a population, a group, into subgroups. And each of them is a class. And of course you can do that lots of different ways. When it comes to human communities and you want to classify them, it means taking a population of people in a village, in a region, in the world, however you like, and breaking them down into subgroups. And human beings have been doing that for as long as we have a record of what human beings think and write and say to one another. So classification, class analysis, that is an analysis based on classifying, is as old as human thought. It is a commonplace, for example, in biology, that in order to understand how nature works, you have to break things down. One-celled organisms as opposed to multiple-celled organisms. Mammals as opposed to other kinds of animals. Those are all classifications. So when it comes to a human community, how have humans classified people? In all kinds of ways, and they're still doing that. For example, to be very modern, when the New York Times writes articles about the wars and struggles in Iraq, it breaks down the population of Iraq in order to tell a story about what's happening there into subgroups. Now, it doesn't call them classes, because there's a taboo on that language for reasons I'll come to. So, for example, it makes sense of Iraq by subdividing people as the following: Shiites, Sunnis, Kurds, Turkmen, and so these are religious, ethnic, regional, these are classifications, all right, and you see what's being done. In order to tell a story about what's happening in the big group, Iraq, you break it down into subgroups, and you tell the story using that subgroup. If you are determined not to think in terms of class, then you do it, for example, the way the New York Times does, by making it as if it were the most natural and necessary thing in the world to analyze the totality of the population in Iraq by means of subgroups defined in terms of religion and region and ethnicity. So how to subdivide, how to classify a human community is always open to grab. Different people do it differently. Okay, so much for the general idea. Now let's go look at the way class has been used when that word itself is the word used to talk about the subgroups. Not the Sunnis and the Shiites, not the men and the women, another classification. Not the old and the young, another classification. But let's talk about how the word class has been used itself. When you've classified into groups, you call classes. Has that been going on for a long time in human history? Yes, very long. Is that particularly a Marxist idea? Not at all. Very important that before we begin to talk about the Marxist concept of class and how it's used, that you be aware that long before Marx was alive, class was used. As far back as ancient Greece and Rome, for example, abundant records showing that people broke the community down into different groups of people, which they called classes. How did they do that? Well, probably the oldest one that we have any record of is what we're going to call a property theory of class, a concept of class that defines class in terms of property. And here's how that works. And I urge you to pay attention because even though this is an old one, it's also very modern. It is used all the time, as you will see, today. Yesterday, the day before yesterday. You're going to see it's on television, it's in books and articles you read, and so on. Anyway, it's very old. Here's the idea. You will understand a community of people by breaking down their membership, classifying them, into groups called classes, and the principle of classification, how you divide people, is, and here we go now, according to the property they own or do not own. So we have the group of people who own a lot, and the group of people who don't own anything. And if you like, you can have all kinds of gradations. The people who own a bit, but not a lot. People who own quite a bit, but not a ton. And people who are really loaded. There are varieties of words over the history of the human race that have been used to classify people into the class of owners and the class of the ownerless. The propertied, the propertyless. The haves and the have-nots. The rich and the poor. You get the picture? These are all different ways of organizing your society in terms of the classes who have property of some kind, wealth, and those who don't, and those who might be, very American now, in the middle class. They don't own a lot, but they're not propertyless either. They're in the middle. Very, very old. So, for example, if you go to ancient Greece, you can read, and there are wonderful books about this, some written by Marxists, for example, and others not, in which Greek society is understood as a complicated society. But if you want to understand how and why Greek society worked, I'm talking ancient Athens, Pericles, and all of that long ago. If you want to understand how it worked, how it changed over time, the argument goes, the way to understand that, the clue, the road into understanding, comes from asking these questions. Who had the property in ancient Greece? And who didn't? And how was the society divided? What was the relationship and the ratio between those who had and those who didn't? Such people, for example, would be very interested to discover that in ancient Greek society, where democracy was born, a minority of people had all the wealth. And the majority of people not only had no wealth, they were wealth. Because the majority of people in ancient Greece were slaves. The people themselves were the property of others. Not only did they not own anything, they didn't own themselves as individuals, as living bodies and minds. So you have a stark example of a person who believes in this kind of class analysis, that understanding comes from seeing how there are classes of owners and classes of propertyless, and then making sense of the society by the relations between them, the tensions between them, the envy between them, the admiration, all of the complicated relationships between the one class of rich and the other class of poor, and perhaps one or more middle classes. Okay? There are sociologists and political scientists and many radicals around the world who still use the same concept. I won't embarrass anyone in the room by asking whether any of you, when you think about class analysis, say of the United States today, also think almost automatically, well, yes, there's the rich and the poor, and the relationships between them, and the middle, and how it relates to the above and the below it. And that's what you do. There are huge amounts of work being produced right now in American journals, dozen of them, popular ones, academic ones, everything in between, in which an analysis is couched about the United States, often using the word class, often not, because it's a repressed discourse, but nonetheless, in that relationship between rich and poor is thought to lie the key to unlocking what's going on in the United States. So this is a class analysis that divides people according to the property they own and makes sense of the world. Notice, to go back to my example of Iraq, if the New York Times' articles make sense of Iraq by the struggle between Sunnis and Shiites and Turkmen and Kurds, that's going to lead you to a very different understanding of what's going on there as compared to the kind of analysis you would get if you said, who owns the wealth in Iraq? Who doesn't? And what are the tensions and relationships there? That's a question very different from what's their ethnicity, what's your religion, and it turns out it might give you, and I guarantee you it does, a very different understanding of what's happening there, what the point and purpose of the American invasion was and is, where the future is going, and so forth. Okay, so it's very important to see these as different. Is this property concept, the notion of classes, the rich versus the poor? And by the way, there's a corollary to that. You can ask rich versus poor, not in terms of the wealth you own, but in terms of the income you're getting. So then the class of people who get a lot of money each year versus the people who get a little and the people who get none at all. So looking at the income breakdown, richer and poorer, is just another way of asking about classes, as if class was about how much money you get or how much money you own or wealth. Are there other concepts of class, using that word? Yes, and they're as old as the property one. Here's another one, very old, long before Marx or Marxism appeared on this earth. And I call this one the power theory of class, the power concept. Here we break down people in a community, we classify them into groups, subgroups, not in terms of what they own or earn, more or less, but in a completely different way. How much power do they wield? How much authority do they have? Are they order givers? Do they tell other people what to do? Or are they order receivers? They're told what to do. They're given orders. They have authority wielded over them. And you have all heard these. It's the class of the powerful versus the class of the powerless. It's the ruling class and the ruled. You're dividing people according to the power they do or do not have. And you make sense of a society in terms of the relationships between those who do have power and those who don't. So, for example, the American Revolution back in the 18th century was fought on a question of power. There was hatred for King George III in England because he, as the sovereign of Great Britain, of which the United States at that time was a colony, had all the power to make all the decisions, to give all the orders, and the colonists here in the United States had to take orders. And they made a revolt. We don't want to take orders. We don't want anyone to tell us to pay taxes, an order. We want to tell ourselves. No taxation without representation. We. Anyone heard of tea baggers? So this is an old idea. We want power. We want a different class structure, meaning, in these people's mind, a different distribution of power. And in our times, this theory is very powerful, only it has a slightly different name. Democracy. We want there to be a particular distribution of power such that everybody has the same power. One man, one vote. All these images. This is about an analysis that says you want to understand why society works the way it does, why it changes, why we have problems in the world, why we have. It's about power. It's about the people who don't have it, who want it. It's about the people who have it, who don't want to share it. And on and on. And that's another way of making sense. And for example, you would come to a very different understanding of Iraq today if what you saw was not a struggle between Shiites and Sunnis, or even for that matter, a struggle between rich and poor, but rather a struggle between those who have some power and those who are excluded. And make no mistake, you get different understanding depending on which of these classifications, which of these concepts of class you use. For example, Barack Obama is not in the ruling class of America if by that you mean property. He doesn't have much property, but he has a hell of a lot of power. So if you want to talk about who's got the power, he certainly has a lot of that. But he doesn't particularly have a lot of property. And there are lots of people I could introduce you to, and you know them, who have quite a bit of property, but are not much in the realm of power. They don't. That's not what they do. It's not available to them. So you get the different organization of society, a different way of looking at society, if you focus on the class structure in terms of who owns, the property theory, versus the class structure in terms of who has power. That's the power theory. And they are very, very old. Very, very old, long before Marx. Now let's turn to Marx, since we're really interested. Actually, before that, let me refer briefly to yet another concept of class, because we're going to talk about it from time to time. It's not as important as the property and power concepts, and it's not as important as the Marxist concept that he really introduced, that I'm going to come to in a moment, but it's very important. This is called the consciousness theory of class. And this says the class you're in, how you divide people in a society into classes, is not to be understood in terms of the property they do or do not own, and is not to be understood in terms of the power they do or do not wield. It's got a completely different definition. People are in classes according, in this theory, to where they think they are. That your class participation, your class position, and the class structure of a society depends first and foremost on people's consciousness. You are what you think you are. So, for example, there's an old joke that I first heard from an African-American woman preacher. And she was giving a sermon in Connecticut, where I was at the time, and she said, I want to talk about the three great classes in America. By the way, my ears perked up because I was so excited at the thought that here in this Baptist church, I was going to hear some class analysis. And she said, there's the haves, there's the have-nots, but I want to talk to the third group because it's the biggest group in this room and it's the biggest group in America. It's the think-they-haves. Very clever, very clever. What she didn't know, because she didn't have a course like this to help her, was that this is a very old idea, that you're in a class based on how you think this society works and how you therefore understand your own position. And this image is evoked often by people who are very proud and smug about the United States and who claim we don't have class conflict because we don't have classes, and we don't have classes because everybody here is in the middle class. And if you push them, they say, I can prove it to you. And then they go out and they do a survey and they discover that 95% of people asked in the United States what class they're in answer proudly that they're in the middle class. Okay? This very interesting way of thinking, but what's going on here is a use of the term class to say you're in a class you're in depending on how you think about the world and your place in it. So all of these are old, and all of these are very new. If you read the speeches of George Bush about the world, and unfortunately also Mr. Obama about the world, then the world is made sense of as a place where there's a struggle between the class of people who want to hold back, by using their power, the spread of democracy, and the others in the world who are trying to change the distribution of power to make for a democratic. The word democratic is used rather than to create an egalitarian class structure, because that's scary language. We don't want to use the class language, so we use this democracy language. But again, democracy is about a particular distribution of power, one that does not have all the power in a few hands with everybody else without power. Rather, the power should be distributed. We want, in the United States these days, ideologically, we want an equal distribution of power, almost as badly as we don't want an equalization of property. Indeed, the intensity of the commitment to an egalitarian distribution of power is the inverse other side of such an anxiety and fear about an egalitarian distribution of wealth. But the main point not to lose sight of, people have been talking about classes, rich versus poor, the property theory, powerful versus powerless, the property, the power theory, excuse me. And finally, the consciousness theory. Class is a matter of how you understand your world and your position in it for a very long time, just as these are all very widespread today. We're not going to use these class concepts in the rest of this class. We're going to use the different concept that Marx invented and gave to us as his contribution. And if you think other concepts of class have been repressed with the word, that's nothing compared to how this Marxian one has been repressed, because that's even more the case, which is why we're doing this course, to undo that repression, to allow us to think and talk about it rather than to keep it buried in the closets of the past. But before I turn to Marxists, let me just emphasize one more time that to talk about a different concept of class is not to say that the difference between rich and poor is unimportant, or the difference between those who have power and those who don't, it doesn't matter. Not at all. It's been important for people all through history that property is unequally distributed and what that means, just as it has been important how power is distributed and what that means. And it has been important what people's consciousness is. Those are important parts of social life and of how societies work. Anyone interested in society who didn't care about that thing would be missing part of the story. So nothing that I say, and nothing to be read in Marx, is to denigrate, deny, or demote the importance of property, power, and consciousness. Indeed, the Marxist agenda is about adding something to the lexicon of class, to the way of thinking, not cashiering others, not denouncing others, not ignoring other things, but rather to remedy something repressed, something overlooked, something missed. That was Marx's idea, and that's what we're going to focus on for the rest of this session of courses today and the next four. So what did Marx do? First of all, he talked a lot about property and power and consciousness. He made all kinds of contributions to those questions, some of which are very famous. I'll give you an example. He was very interested not just in property in general, that struck him as silly. He was particularly interested in property in what he called means of production. Who owns the factories, the land, the way we have the raw materials and the tools to produce? Who controls those by ownership? Struck Marx as particularly important, and he talked about that. And likewise, he thought power was an important matter. Who was in a position to give orders? What was the position of military, police, concentrated order givers in a society? He had a lot to say about that. And he was certainly interested in consciousness. Some of the most famous passages that people know about in Marxism is, for example, his discourse on something called the fetishism of commodities. Fetish is a way of thinking. It's about consciousness. It's how people relate to this thing called the market and commodities and so forth. Marx was very interested in that. So Marx wrote about, was interested in property, power, and consciousness. But his contribution was to add a new and different concept of class, to teach us, that's what he thought he was doing, that there is something else going on in society that he wanted to call class. It was a way of classifying people into their positions in society that differentiated them one from another, but not according to the property they own, not according to the power they wielded, and not according to their consciousness, but according to something else. So the question is, what else? What was it that Marx was so determined to convey? What had he figured out about the world that he could contribute? Because after all, he was a writer. He was an intellectual. Again, just to remind you, right, he's a child of middle-classy folks. He did something extraordinary at his time in the middle of the 19th century. He went to the university. 1% of people did that, if that. You know, the majority of Germans at that time were probably illiterate. And they certainly didn't go to school, and they certainly didn't go to university. So he goes to the university, and he studies, heaven help us, philosophy. Writes a dissertation about ancient Greek philosophy and becomes a young philosophy professor. We're not talking about 1% of the German population. We're talking about 0.00001% of the population that he's part of. So he then spends the rest of his life writing things. He goes, does some other things, he organizes meetings, but he's a writer and a thinker. And he can't even stay in his home country of Germany. He's exiled, spends most of his productive life in a different country, speaking a different language, namely in England. So this is a man who has spent his life trying to figure something out, and as well as being an activist, but secondarily to his life as a thinking person. So here's what he can offer. He thought something through. He saw something. He went to work to check whether it was right. He did an awful lot of work, and he concluded he had something to offer. To whom? He always felt himself a radical. He always felt himself a person who wants to make society better. And he had a very clear idea what better meant. And there's no reason to shy away from that. Marx was a committed, ethical, moral human being who was proud of his moral and ethical commitments. That is important to keep in mind, since some later generations of Marxists seem to need to believe that Marxism wasn't about moral and ethical commitments, but was about a scientific understanding. Read Marx. His passion and his ethics are on every page. He knew who he loved and he knew who he hated. And to summarize that, because you'll see it's important, what Marx loved and what his ethical shining light was the French Revolution. Marx was born in 1818. That's roughly 40 years after the French Revolution. So it's not very long. The French Revolution is the explosion that destroys feudalism. It cuts off the head of Louis the 16th? 16th, okay. And Marie Antoinette, you all know the story, the guillotine, very dramatic. And in the name of the great three-word slogan of the French, liberté, égalité, fraternité, liberty, equality, and brotherhood. In the name of those three, we are transforming society, ending centuries of monarchy, ending centuries of inequality of property and power and so forth. And we're going to build a new world, completely different, on the foundation of liberty, equality, and fraternity. Unbelievably dramatic, revolutionary idea. It happened in France, but Marx was born in Trier, which is a German city close to France. What happened in France is hot news in the town he was born in. And all young intellectuals, with very few exceptions, in Germany, at the time he comes of age of his 20s and 30s, is overwhelmed by the French Revolution and what it means as it sweeps across Europe, first with Napoleon's armies, but afterwards through all the other mechanisms of cultural dispersion, and they're all caught up in this. And Marx is one of a generation of Germans, many, 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 and indeed generation of people all over Europe, in Italy and Spain and everywhere else, who are caught up in the drama and the romance of this world-shaking transformation into equality, fraternity, and brotherhood. But Marx is an honest guy and faces a mystery early in his life, around the 1830s and 40s. The promised new world of the great French Revolution, in which he believed and hoped, wasn't arriving. Germany, as he becomes old enough and mature enough to look around, particularly in the more developed part of Germany, Western Germany, where he comes from, the places around Frankfurt and Mainz and those cities in Germany, in the western end of Germany, close to the French border, he looks around. Does he see liberty, equality, and fraternity? On the contrary, he sees inequality, no freedom, and everything but fraternity. He sees the end of feudalism, but the arrival of the industrial working class living in horrible conditions. The conditions in Germany in that period of time were worse than the conditions in England at that period of time, and those were the conditions that appear in Charles Dickens's novels. So he is, as part of his generation, terribly upset. The great revolution to sweep and transform Europe wasn't working. Feudalism had indeed been overthrown. It was gone. There were no more serfs. The kings were gone. Wow. But where was the liberty, equality, and fraternity? And so he set himself, again like others in his generation, the simple question. What happened? What went wrong? What is it we didn't do that prevented us from realizing the point and purpose of all these revolutions? By the way, included the American Revolution, about the same time as the French. What went wrong? And that's really what he went to study. And was driven by his passion and his morals and his ideals. And Marx, unlike so many others, came up with a unique, distinctive explanation. And in the course of it, figured out something that he then bequeaths to the rest of us by writing it up at great length. He's a very prolific writer. Above all, in the three volumes of Capital, his mature major work of his life, but in many other writings and speeches he gave as well. So what he did, I'm going to argue with you, is to figure out, to invent, and to present to us a new and different concept of class. Was he the first person to talk about class analysis? I've already shown you, not at all. What he contributed was a different way of understanding class, in which what your class position is, how you relate to class, what class means in your life, is something different from property, power, and consciousness. Wow. And to give you the punchline of why it pays to pay attention to what Marx wrote, here's his argument. The reason our earlier efforts, we who are progressive, we who are modern, we who love the ideals of the French and American and other revolutions, the reason it failed was we did make changes in property, we did make changes in power, and we did make changes in consciousness. But we didn't make some other changes, and therein lies the flaw. We didn't understand that something else had to be changed. And because we didn't pay attention to it, we didn't change it very much. And because we didn't change it very much, we couldn't even hold on to those gains in the distribution of power, property, and consciousness that the revolutions achieved. So the revolutions, instead of being the step to liberty, equality, and fraternity, faded out. And we ended up with a society, mid-19th century Europe, which has no liberty, no equality, and no fraternity. So it's important, says Marx, to see this thing so we don't make that mistake again. So that the next upsurges of human beings in the interest of liberty, equality, and fraternity will be more successful than we have been. That's what he leaves to the next generation. And my argument, as you'll see, is that we remain the people to whom this message is given. It'll be up to us whether this time we can get it, as earlier generations of Marxists didn't. Let me then turn to what is it that Marx did? And I'm not going to go through, because we don't have the time, all the steps Marx used to get there. I'm going to give you the end result, because we're going to have to work with it for the rest of this class, and so I only have the time to present it to you here. But if any of you are interested, believe me, there are ways in which there's literature out there, and you can pursue it, and I'd be glad to provide that to anyone who wishes. Here's Marx's conclusion. Human beings are engaged in a process that they have not very well understood. And some had glimpses. I see in the works of predecessors of mine, in ancient writings, but in modern writings too, Marx says, glimpses of this, but they never kind of put it all together, and I want to do that. And by the way, if you're interested, Marx has another three-volume work that very few people know about. It isn't called Capital, but it is three volumes, and it's about as long as Capital altogether. And these three volumes are called Theories of Surplus Value. And what they are Marx's notes, because he was a very close and careful researcher. And he wrote out notes. There are three volumes of his notes on all of the major thinkers before him that, in his view, glimpsed something of what I'm about to tell you. And he there shows you his personal debt and the debt of his insight to all the people that come before. Unusual for a thinker to write. Very few major thinkers in the modern world who have been as careful and as open as Marx in showing his intellectual debts. By the way, you will see in these volumes, if you're interested, long detailed analyses by Marx of people that you know, Adam Smith, David Ricardo, and a whole host of other thinkers. And it's really interesting because, again, you don't see that often, a person who lays out how much he has learned. And by the way, no dismissal there. He's very respectful to these people. He does make criticisms, but it's in the context of an immense appreciation. So what is it that people, except for these forebears that he honors, what is it they missed? And I would argue that this is not only missed in the people who come before Marx, it's still missed, which is why I'm doing what I'm doing, because if it wasn't missed, you wouldn't need this course. But what is it that's missed? Here's his answer. Throughout human history and in all human communities, something happens that we don't take cognizance of enough, that we don't pay attention to and we don't integrate into our way of thinking. In every human community, something happens that I think is crucial for us to focus on, and let me tell you what it is, he says. In every community, some portion of the people, typically adults, spend their time using their brains and their muscle to transform nature into a whole bunch of products. They make things. To use modern language, they do work. So, for example, they use their brains and their muscles to transform a tree into a chair, to transform some plants that they grow into a loaf of bread, to take care of animals and process them into a woolen shirt, and so on. They do work. But in every human community, of which there's any record, past and present, it's always true that a part of the society doesn't do work, doesn't do that, doesn't spend their time using brains and muscles to transform nature into products. And so in every community, there has to be a way developed to make the following decisions. One, who's in the two groups? Who is going to be doing the work and who isn't? Number two, the people who don't do the work are going to die because of no food, no shelter, no clothing, unless the people who, here comes the punchline now, unless the people who do the work produce more stuff than they themselves consume. There has to be an extra produced by those who work if you're going to sustain the people in the community who don't. Marx's language there. The work that those who do work do, the fruits of which they themselves consume, is only ever a part of what they produce. The people who work can never stop working once they have produced what they themselves consume. They don't stop working when they've made enough food, clothing, shelter, etc., to clothe and feed themselves, because they, here we go, socially, have to produce more than they themselves consume to enable those who don't work to also consume. The part of the work that the workers do that take care of them, that takes care of themselves, Marx referred to as necessary labor. It's the labor necessary for the laborer to keep going, to keep working. But the part of the work that the workers do that's in excess of that, that's more than what's necessary to take care of themselves, that is, in English, called surplus labor. It's the part of the labor of the working portion of the community that is in excess to what they themselves consume. By the way, in Marx's writing, in German, he uses the very simple language. There's the labor that the workers do that takes, that sustains themselves, and then there is more work. He uses the German word mehr, M-E-H-R, which is the German equivalent of the English more. He says there's more work that they do, but they don't get the fruits of that work. Whoa, here we go, pay attention. People produce more than they themselves get. And that more is, mystery of mysteries, transferred, transmitted, distributed to the people who don't work. And, says Marx, how each society organizes this process is a way of differentiating one society from another, because human communities have and continue to do this in different ways. And how a community does it, how it decides who does the work, how it decides how the people who do the work, how big a surplus are they going to produce, and who is going to get it, and how is it going to be distributed to those every society has to decide that. Every society does decide it. But, says Marx, they do it differently. And how they do it, here comes the punchline, shapes the society. Shapes its politics, shapes its culture, shapes its history, shapes its tensions, shapes its love affair, shapes everything. And if you don't understand that, you're not going to see an important shaper of the world you live in and the life you're leading. And you're sure as hell, here we go now, not going to be able to make the kinds of social changes you're after. Because here's what you might do. You might change the property in a society. You might change the power. And you might change the consciousness. And all of that's important. But if you don't think about, know about, the organization of the surplus, and you don't change that, the unchanged nature of the organization of the surplus may come back and bite you in the rear end. How? By undoing those changes in property, power, and consciousness that you did achieve. Which, as you will see, I'm going to be arguing, is precisely what happened over and over again. In the French Revolution, in the Russian Revolution, in the Chinese Revolution, and therefore the most important lesson perhaps modern rebels and radicals can learn, so they don't reproduce the mistake again. So Marx's argument is that he wants to introduce into the radical community that thinks in terms of class analysis, so he accepts that environment, that language, that tradition, but he says there's another kind of class structure that going on that you haven't understood that we need to come to terms with, and I'm going to now tell you what I figured out about it. Okay? That's his project. That's why, just in a footnote, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the literature, but if you actually sit down and you read the three volumes of Capital, Marx's mature, sort of majestic work of his adulthood, you'll see that it's about the surplus. Volume 1 of Capital is about how surplus is produced in a capitalist society, like the one we live in. And volumes 2 and 3 are about how the surplus gets distributed to all the people who don't participate in its production. That's what it's about. It's not about property primarily, it's not about power primarily, and it's not about consciousness. It talks about those things because they were important to Marx. But the central organizing topic of Marx's work is the production and distribution of surplus in a society, and in particular in a modern capitalist society. Okay, let's begin now to develop this Marxist idea. What the specificity and uniqueness of a Marxian class analysis amounts to. As I said to you, Marx's insight was that the surplus is organized, the production of it, the distribution of it, differently in different societies. And he went to work to catalog that, to show that. And to make his argument, he made, as all theorists do, certain simplifying assumptions so his story could be told. It's bad enough you write something in three volumes, right? How many people have the patience to read one, let alone three? So it was hard even to crunch it as much as he did. But he did. And he developed five basically different ways, five, that human societies have organized the surplus. And I'm now quickly going to go through them because we're going to need them when we analyze, using Marxian class analysis, every society that we're going to think about in this course. Why? Because most societies, certainly the United States today, but most societies have all of these five going on in them at the same time. Okay? So please, as we go through these five, do not think of a society as either one or the other. Most societies are mixtures of these different class societies. And when I'm done, I'm going to use the United States as an example to show you concretely how here in the United States we have all five of them. Now let me go through them. First, the one to which Marx gave an interesting name, a name that has worried people ever since. The name he gave was communism. So he gives the name communism to a way of organizing the surplus. So what is that way? Very simple to explain. Really is. Marx does all this work for us. That's why it's simple. It's not a simple idea. It's now simple to express because a lot of work has been done. Here's the idea. In a communist economic arrangement, in a communist class structure, what we have is the part of the population, the subgroup, that does the work, that uses the brains and muscle to transform nature. They themselves, here we go now, they're the ones who get the surplus. That is, they produce that extra, the beyond what they themselves consume, but here comes the key point. They not only produce the surplus, but they themselves take hold of the surplus. It's theirs. And they distribute it to the rest of the community. Wow. Why did Marx use the term communist? Because it's the community of the workers who does the distribution. The community of workers gets their own extra, their surplus. The more output they produce beyond what they themselves consume. It's the community of workers who, now using Marx's language, appropriates, takes the surplus they themselves have produced and distribute them. That's what makes it communal, community, communist. Please notice, nothing in Marx's definition makes any reference whatsoever to the state or the government. It's irrelevant to his definition of communism. So when you hear the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the evening TV news talk about communism or a powerful state as if nothing were more normal, natural, and universally agreed as that, you are now in a position to sneer. Because this is ignorance, and not an innocent ignorance either. The notion that communism has a powerful state has to do with the Soviet Union and China. With whatever you think about them, pro or con, that's what that's about. It's the identification of this concept of communism with those particular countries, but it has nothing to do with Marx. Nothing. Marx never wrote a book about the state. Wasn't important enough to him. He had plans, if you notice his plans at the end, he had plans to write about the state, it's an interesting topic, but it was not his primary interest. And his definition of communism had nothing to do with it. Communism is one way to organize the surplus. Here's the second way. And Marx gave to that a funny name. It isn't useful, but I'm going to use it because it's in the literature. He called it the ancient class structure. Not the communist, the ancient. Funny word because it implies long ago. But this ancient is as present today as it ever was long ago. Here's what it is. In this arrangement, The work is done not by a group of people, the way I've been talking about it up to now, but by each individual alone. The adult man or woman who's out there using his, her brains and muscles to transform nature to produce goods. Think of an individual farmer or peasant. Think of an individual craftsman or woman. Think of an individual person making software with their laptop in the garage. The point here is an individual, and Marx's argument is, that individual cannot and never does stop working when he or she has produced enough goods and services to sustain themselves. As with the community, the communist class structure, the individual who works on his or her own always produces more than they themselves consume. They also always produce a surplus, which they also distribute to other people. And so Marx is fascinated. This is a different way. What these two ways, communist and ancient, have in common is something very profound. The people who make the surplus get it and distribute it. That, he thinks, is remarkable. But they're very different because in the first one, it's a collective of people that are doing that. In the second one, it's an individual. What are some of the modern terms for Marx's idea of the ancient class structure? The self-employed person. The self-employed. Interesting word. Same idea. So it's very modern. Think of an individual doctor, individual dentist, individual architect, individual software engineer, individual you fill in the blank. So that's two, the communist and the ancient. The next three, out of the five, there's only three left, the next three are different ways of organizing the surplus. And their key difference, for Marx, is that in each of the next three, you're going to notice something different from the first two. And here's the difference. In the next three, the people who produce the surplus don't get it. They do not participate in distributing it. Right? In the first two, the communist and the ancient, the person or persons who produce the surplus get it and distribute it. In the next three, the people who produce the surplus don't get it and they don't distribute it. And Marx has a very important term to describe those organizations of the surplus in which the people who produce it don't get it. Those systems he called exploitative. The word exploitation in Marx has a precise definition. It has nothing to do with whether or not you're nice to the people who work there, whether you beat them or underpay them or anything else. It has nothing to do with that. Exploitation exists if and only if the people who produce a surplus are not the people who get it and distribute it. Other people are. So let's go through the three exploitative class structures that Marx identified. First, slavery. In a slave system, we have what? We have one group of people who work, use their brains and muscles, they transform nature. I'll give you an example. African-American slaves working in cotton plantations in the American South before the Civil War. Every day they got up, they used their brains and their muscles to plant cotton, harvest cotton, all the rest. At the end of the day, or week or year, it doesn't matter, all, it's very important, all of the fruits of their labor go to somebody else, the master. They get nothing. They're slaves. They're entitled to nothing. The master, takes a portion of what the slaves have produced and returns it to them because he wants them to be able to work the next day. He has to feed them, he has to take care of them. And not just enough that they get by biologically, but that they don't revolt, don't kill him, and all the rest of it. So the master, who gets the whole product of the slave's work, returns a portion of it to the slave, to reproduce the slave. But the rest of it, the surplus, the part of what the slave produced as excess to what the slave gets back, is not the slave's. It belongs instantaneously, indeed the whole product does, to the master. And it's the master who distributes it. So notice, in the slave structure, the people who do the work and produce the surplus don't get it and don't distribute it. Other people do. That's an exploitative class structure for Marx and in Marx's system. So that's the third one. Now the fourth one, feudalism. Feudalism. By the way, don't associate these words with particular parts of the world or particular periods of time, even though those names are taken from that. Feudalism comes from medieval Europe. These are types of class structure, and as I'm going to show you, they exist everywhere, always. All that really matters is the combinations of them, the proportion in any country of the one versus the other. As I told you, when we're done, I'm going to show you the United States has them all five of them. What's the feudal one? In the feudal one, we have a group, again, of people who do the work. They're not slaves. They're not the property of somebody else. That's what distinguishes this exploitative system from slavery. The serf, using the tradition of European serfdom and feudalism, is tied to the land. Literally, where you grow up, the land being farmed by your mother and father is where you stay. Their lord, I'm going to tell you in a minute what a lord is your lord because you're born into this arrangement. You're nobody's property, you're not a slave, you're a serf, and the serf is tied to the land. And here's how it worked, to give you an example, in European feudalism. 3 days of every week, you work on the land allocated to you and your family. You raise animals, you grow crops, and you keep, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you work on your own piece of land. By the way, it's not your piece because there wasn't, in European feudalism, no private property in land. And let me do that again. They didn't allow private property. One more time. No private property in land. So the land was assigned to you. The Lord assigned it to you, but in the ideology of feudalism, God assigned it to you. Because to think of private property was denounced in medieval Europe as a sin against Jesus Christ and an arrogance of the human community that was intolerable to the Lord, the one up in the sky. Why? Because human beings didn't put that land there. God put us there on the land. And the idea that the man or woman said, "This is mine," is an arrogance against the Lord. It is taking unto yourself power that doesn't belong to you, and that is an affront to the way the world really works. And to say I have rights of power is a blasphemy, for which in the Middle Ages they would cook you, literally. Okay? So in feudalism, people are assigned to the land. And for 3 days of the week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, the serf works on the piece of land assigned to him or her. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, the same serfs leave that land and they go to the domain of the Lord, the big shot in the area, who has a big piece of land, and they work on that. And now watch. The fruits of their labor for Thursday, Friday, Saturday, on the land assigned to the Lord, he gets. On Sunday, as you know, we rest. We go to church in the morning, and we eat too much in the afternoon, and we sleep it off in the evening. And then we resume the week. Notice, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, the serfs are producing an output that they themselves keep and consume. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, the serfs are working to produce an output that is not theirs and that they do not distribute. The lord of the manor, the feudal lord, takes that output, the surplus, and he gets it and he distributes it. So now we've accounted for four: communist, ancient, slave, and feudal. The last one, capitalist. It is also exploitative because, as I will show you, there is a group of people who produce a surplus, but they're not the people who get it and distribute it. Somebody else does. And this, by the way, Marx is not a detailed analyst of communism, never wrote about that in any kind of detail, ever. Nor did he ever write about socialism. These are not topics that occupied his attention. Engels once wrote a famous pamphlet, and even that was a kind of political pamphlet more than anything else, but it's an interesting one if you're ever interested. It's the only time you have a sustained discussion of socialism and communism. It's a pamphlet called Socialism, Utopian and Scientific. But it's more an ideological and polemic than it is an analytic. Marx analyzed capitalism. That's the only system he really went through. Why? He didn't believe in prediction. He thought that was a silly activity. Nobody can predict. He didn't know what's going to happen in the future. Nobody else does either. What he could analyze was how capitalism worked and draw some conclusions about that, which might be applicable to other societies, but beyond that, he didn't go. So we do really have the benefit of Marx on capitalism in a way we do not have him on anything else. So how does capitalism work, he says. And again, I'm now going to use a modern American idiom to get it across because it's easier than trying to take you through Marx's language. But it's all in Volume 1 of Capital, very neatly point out. If you ever have a chance, read it. It's a beautifully written book, by the way, full of irony and humor and passion, as well as economic argument. Those of you who've taken courses in economics, which I have spent my life teaching, I can assure you that this is much more fun and much better written and much more interesting than 99% of what passes for the literature of economics, my own included. Okay, so I'm going to use the American idiom. It works like this, Marx's argument. You're looking for a job. You go to talk to your employer, and you and the employer sit down to discuss your work that you hope to get. And the employer explains to you, this is what we make here, in this factory, this office, this workshop. And if you come to work here, he explains to you, you come at 8 o'clock and you stay till 5 and you have an hour off for lunch or whatever the details are. And then after the nice pleasantries and you make the right questions and make the right body movements to show how interested you are in this job and the employer does the same in reverse to you, then you get to that hairy point about the money. And the question is, how much are you going to get paid? At that point, the conversation works something like this, Marx would say, if he were using the modern idiom. Let's suppose the employer proposes, and let's suppose, to make this quick, you accept $20 an hour. Okay, you agree. You're going to come 8 o'clock, Monday to Friday, stay till 5, each of those 5 days, and you're going to be paid $20 for every hour that you put in effort. And you understand when you come, that morning at 8 o'clock each day, the employer will tell you where to go, what tools to use, what raw material to work on, what system of work to use, and you will apply, hopefully honestly and earnestly, you will apply your brains, your muscles, whatever you've learned, to do the job you're asked to do. And at the end of the day, at 5 o'clock, you go home. You leave behind what you produced. Let me do that again. You've poured your creativity and your labor into something. You've produced something. It's really an extension of you. And at the end of your work, you go home and you leave it behind. If you take it with you, people in dark blue uniforms come and beat you up because you have stolen what is not yours. It isn't mine. I made it. Not the way the system works. You made it. Here we go now. You don't get it. Now Marx's argument comes. There's only one reason on earth that the employer would ever pay you $20 for every hour of your effort. And that only one reason is the following. During that hour, your labor, your effort, adds to what the employer has to sell more than $20 worth of stuff. Because if all your labor in that hour did was add to, let's suppose this place makes, I don't know, ballpoint pens. If all your hour worth of work did was add an extra $20 worth of pens, which then the employer, who gets to keep it when the day is over, he then goes and sells it. That's what employers do in a modern capitalist system. If what he got for the extra pens your labor produced was $20, which he then had to turn over to you to pay you for the $20 an hour, there'd be nothing in it for him. Worse than that. Because you use up raw materials, you use up equipment, you have to have the light on when you work, so someone has to pay the electricity, he wouldn't even be able to pay his costs. He needs you, here we go now, he needs you to produce more every hour, then you get paid. Because if you don't, he'll never hire you. So the condition of employment in a capitalist system is necessarily that every worker produces a surplus that he doesn't get. The surplus is taken and distributed by somebody else. So, for example, let's say you produce an extra $30 worth of pens in your hour. Good, the employer takes the $30 worth of pens, the extra produced by your hour of work. He sells them for $30. He gives the 20 to you, that's your wage, your salary, and he keeps the other 10. And what happens with the other 10? You might think, you'd be wrong, by the way, you might think, well, he uses it to pay the electric bill and to buy more raw material. He might. But in a capitalist system, that's his choice. He could take the $10 and go to the Bahamas, and you'll never see him again. And the next day when you arrive to work, it'll be locked, and you'll be screwed. Because you do not participate in receiving or distributing that surplus. Somebody else does. And in that way, capitalism isn't different from feudalism or slavery. They are all equally or equivalently exploitative system. Obviously, they're different from one another. A worker in capitalist is not a slave, just like a serf is neither a slave nor a free laborer who contracts with an employer to work. There are differences in this system. But punchline, folks, if you concentrate on the differences, if your way of thinking is all about power, and you're very excited, the slave has no power, doesn't even have power over himself, his own body and life. And here we go now. You have a revolution to overcome slavery, to make everybody free, and you focus on that's a transit. You may miss that exploitation still exists. It's just changed its form. Marx enjoyed using the phrase wage slaves. Why? Hint, he wanted to suggest that there was something that wage earners and slaves had in common. And what they had, Volume 1 of Capital explains. They are exploited. Suppose you raise the wages of a worker. In my example, instead of getting $20 an hour when each hour of your labor gives $30 worth of extra pens to your employer, suppose you have a struggle and a strike with your union and you drive up your wages and you're now going to get $24 an hour, not 20. That's a 20% increase. Hey, you could feel powerful. Very few unions get 20% increases in their wages. Is that a good thing? Yes, from a radical point of view. Does it help the workers? Absolutely. Does it stick it to the employer? You got it. Does it end exploitation? Not at all. It just changes the dimensions. Is the worker still exploited? Absolutely. Absolutely. And suppose it were the case, just for a minute with me, suppose it were the case that exploitation hurts people, eats into their souls, upsets their equilibrium emotionally, psychologically. Then getting a rising wage, which you might have thought was your point and purpose in goal and struggle in life, might leave you as unhappy and as irritated by the fact, what fact? That you're always delivering to your employer more than he pays you. That vague sense that so many workers have in capitalism, that every day is an experience of getting ripped off. That attitude that makes you snatch the ballpoint pen off the desk and stick it somewhere in your body so you can take it home. That makes you take that extra roll of toilet paper in the bathroom to save yourself having to buy it. And some of you are smiling. You know what I mean. Do you ever wonder where that instinct comes from? Even those of you that don't do it because your mother and father told you it's not good to steal, you worry that you might be being stupid by not doing that. And why is that? Because being exploited is something that probably bothers you. How many Americans need to say to each other and to themselves, I'm never going to take a job unless I get paid what I'm worth? Marxism tells you that kind of job is not available, you schmuck. It's not there. You're dreaming, and you're either going to have to face that you're never going to get what you're worth, or you're going to have to live in a fantasy that you are. And a fantasy is a fantasy. It's not a substitute for reality. It coexists with reality, and the coexistence is not peaceful. So Marx's argument is human beings organize something they can't do without. We have to produce. We can't live unless we produce food, clothing, shelter, and a lot of other things. So production is not an option. All communities have production. It's one of the major things they do, usually the most major one. Survival depends on it. And if you produce, you're going to organize the surplus somehow. So every society has an organization of surplus. And they all have one or another or combinations of these five. And so the first interesting thing a Marxist class analysis says is, wow, think of all the societies, including our own today, that have an organization of the surplus, but never discuss it, never argue about it, never question it. Wow. You don't have to be an advanced student of psychology to worry that if there's something fundamental to your life that you can't think or talk about, you got a problem. Right? Those experiences, for example, that we have as children, in difficulties we have with our siblings, with our parents, to borrow from Freud, particularly our earliest, how shall I use the words, explorations in our sexuality, have, because of our culture, all kinds of troubling effects on us. Now, as you become an adult, these things work their way through you, your relationships, or lack thereof, your interactions with other people, and so on. Now, you have two ways to go. You can either ask and explore how these things shape your life, or you can pretend that they don't. They'll shape your life in either way. But generally, the presumption is better off if you think about it and try to work on it. And some of us pay huge amounts of money to professionals to help us to do that. And other of us don't and pretend it's all comedic operations, things to make fun of. Great thinkers have said something I'm going to borrow from now. What Freud did to make individuals begin to recognize that there are parts of their lives that are shaping them, past and present lives, and they would be better off thinking about them and making sense of them than pretending they're not there, Marx is the same thing at the level of society. Societies would be better off if they came to terms with, recognized, thought about, and discussed with one another the parts of their culture and society that are shaping them, but that they have been too afraid, too repressed to deal with. Class analysis is, for Marx, that. He wants to get a return of the repressed, to overcome the repression of this reality of surplus organization that every society has. We will be better off if we face it and deal with it than if we pretend it isn't there. Or to be more pointed, we'll be much more successful in building a world of liberty, equality, and fraternity if we figure out how we have to change the class structure, the organization of surplus. And notice, to talk about the organization of surplus and changing it is different from talking about power, property, and consciousness. Okay? Before I go on, I promised you, and I'm going to do it now, how the United States has all of them, all five of them. So let's go through it quickly. I'm not going to bother explaining to you how it has capitalism, because you all know that. Many of you work in a capitalist enterprise. They're all around us, employer, employee. You know that, so I don't have to. But now the ancient, well, you kind of know that too, right? The ancient is the self-employed person, works on his or her own, produces enough to sustain themselves, but produces more as well, and they distribute. Let's take the individual dentist. He or she has an office, and they go in there, and they torture you with root canals and all the other things that they do. And do they do that enough to sustain themselves, their income? Yes. Do they stop there? Never. Why? Because they have lots of other expenses to take care of beyond themselves. They have to pay the electricity that keeps the lights on, that works those drills that hurt. They have to buy all that equipment. They have to pay the receptionist. They have to pay taxes. They have to pay for the security services. They have lots of expenses. They have to do a surplus. Ask any dentist. They wish they could go home at the end of those hours in the day that they have worked to earn enough money to live at whatever standard of living they can't. So of course they produce a surplus, but they get it. And indeed, one of the great charms of being a dentist or an architect or a doctor or any of these other kinds of workers, if you ask them, is, to use the American idiom, I'm my own boss. I am my own boss. I make my own decisions. They love that. We have a culture that venerates that class structure, the self-employed. I do an experiment. I teach at the University of Massachusetts often, and I often teach large classes of 300 students. And I circulate a little piece of paper. Each student gets a piece of paper, and I often ask them, write down for me, among other things, you know, what your major is and where you come from and so forth. What do you hope to be doing 5 years after you graduate? Because I've always learned, I learn a lot about these students to know what they think, what they hope. 2/3 of them write down, I want to be my own boss. It is a beautiful commentary on the ideology that has picked out one class structure as the desirable one. Two things are true. First, the overwhelming majority of them cannot do that because there are no such jobs. The number of them that will ever be self-employed is tiny. They must know that somewhere, since the communities they all come from, it's very obvious all the time, including their own parents. And the second thing is, those people who are self-employed are working their asses off most of the time. What kind of desideratum is that? The image and the reality, which they know are askew, but it's such a powerful image and a draw that they imagine it. Anyway, we have lots of self-employed people. So we have a capitalist class structure, and we have an ancient class structure. But now let me tantalize you, because some of this we're going to go into in the next classes. Do we have slavery? Of course we do. Do we have places where slaves produce a surplus that they don't get, where the slave master gets the fruit of their labor and then gives them back some of it to sustain them, because he needs them to keep going, but he keeps the surplus? Sure. Let me give you just a few examples. We have professional baseball. In professional baseball, teams, ready, sell people to one another. Let's do that again. Many of you have never thought about this because they're paid a lot of money. That's cute. They're paid a lot of money. It has nothing to do with whether you're a slave or not. Are you the property of somebody who can sell you? Yes. Yes. Can you decide to do that? No. The only way you can escape the slavery of baseball is to leave baseball. That you can do. That's interesting. So it's a kind of a partial slavery. That means you're a slave in this realm, but you're not a slave in that realm. Here's another example. A little harder to document because it's illegal. Prostitution. All over the United States, there are prostitutes. Prostitutes often have, male and female, prostitutes often have pimps. The relationship between the prostitute and the pimp, and there are many studies that often, not always, but often involve slavery. The pimp literally buys and sells to other pimps his stable of prostitutes. They work, they earn the money from what they do, and all of that goes to the pimp, who then gives them the sustenance that they need to keep going, keeping the difference, which is what he's in it for. Okay? So, of course it exists. There are religious communities all over the United States who have something dangerously close to slavery, but they use the privacy, the way prostitution uses its illegality, to hide all of it. But do we have it? You betcha we have it. You betcha. Feudalism. Do we have a situation where one person produces surplus? Part of the time they work, they keep the fruits for themselves, and part of the time it goes to the Lord. Sure we do. All over the place. The biggest place in the United States where feudalism occurs, in the Marxist sense, is in the traditional American household, at home. What's the traditional household? The wife, the adult woman, works. She doesn't work 3 days a week for herself and 3 days a week for somebody else. Here's how it does. She gets up in the morning and she makes breakfast, labor. She transforms raw food into cooked food. Does she do it just to sustain herself? No. She makes eggs and toast and coffee for herself. And another place setting with eggs and toast and coffee for dear hubby. And when she makes the bed, just her side? Nah, she makes the whole bed. And when she cleans underwear, just hers? No, his too. Wow. She does labor. She delivers her surplus to the husband. In our culture, it goes with love, honor, and obey. Or what is it? Love, honor, and cherish, or whatever the words are in the marriage seminar. By the way, the marriage ceremony, if you study it, comes directly out of feudalism. In feudalism, when one person becomes the serf of another, you get down on one knee, you get tapped on the shoulder with a sword, and you swear to love, honor, and obey your lord, who swears in turn to do that for you. And so it's a wonderful ceremony. It just has the peculiar quality that the love, honor, and obey that you each say to the other has the effect that one person's producing surplus for the other, not vice versa. Ditto modern marriage. Same arrangement in the traditional form. So do we have a feudal class structure? You betcha. Your husband doesn't pay you wages, at least it's unusual. And he can't buy and sell you? Not quite. So we have feudalism. We have capitalism. We have slavery. We have ancient. Now the communist, all over the place. All over the place. I'll give you two examples. The one that I use a lot, some of you have heard me do it, is from Silicon Valley, the part of our country where we have fancy software engineers. Every year, for 50 years it's been going on, every year dozens, sometimes hundreds of these engineers quit their jobs. They stop working for IBM, they stop working for Cisco Systems, whatever it is, and 10 of them, 20 of them, 40 of them take their laptops and gather in somebody's garage. Instead of getting dressed up in their suits and ties and going to work in the usual manner, they don't have to anymore. They quit their jobs, high-paying jobs, $400,000 a year jobs. They quit them. Now they can come to work in sweatpants, in Hawaiian shirts, high as a kite with frisbees and dogs. And they come to work Monday through Thursday, and they make software the way they always did on their laptops. Friday, they all gather at the worksite, the garage. They don't bring their laptops. They don't bring their dogs. They still bring their cigarettes, that's life. And here's what they do. All day Friday, they sit around and they decide what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. In effect, they function as their own board of directors. But from a Marxian perspective, here's the interesting thing. They have organized their workplace so that the surplus they produce, the quantity of software product, is worth more than what they themselves use to sustain their own standard of living. They produce a surplus, but on Friday, they get it and they distribute it. They have set up a communist class structure. By the way, in surveys, most of these California engineers are and are proud to be Republicans. This arrangement in which they have broken, walked with their feet, they voted against capitalism. They argue, when I worked at that big capitalist enterprise, they don't use this language, I was unproductive, I was unhappy, I didn't do very well, I hated my wife, blah, 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 blah. Now, I'm so happy. I'm much more productive. I work together with people. Everybody is equal here. We have no board of directors and underlings, no supervisor, none of that. We work, we monitor ourselves. They love Marx's idea of a communist enterprise. That's what they've arranged. They're Republicans. By the way, when people change their class structure, they may be conscious of doing that or not. For them to be conscious of what they're doing, they would have had to have, for example, this course. They have not, unfortunately, not yet had that pleasure. So they have to use other language. They have other consciousness. So, for example, in Silicon Valley, if you talk to people who have done this, they will tell you about how proud they are of their, here we go now, innovative entrepreneurialism. Whoa. Who cares? Let them call it green bananas. In Marxian theory, those people have made a revolution overthrowing capitalism and substituting a communist class structure, in Marx's sense. And here's a little implication of this. Imagine a left in America which was able to say to the American people, our idea of reorganizing society to give it a better chance of liberty, equality, and fraternity can point to a concrete example here in the United States of workers who've done that. And look, many of these enterprises, by the way, have been going for 50 years. They are successful. They do what they set out to do. And by the way, they're not the only examples. There are others doing that exact same thing, calling it a whole variety of things. But you shouldn't be surprised that they don't call it by its Marxian name, because Marxian theory is a repressed discourse in the United States. It's not taught in most universities. It's not part of the public language. It's not in the mass media. So, of course, they don't have the vocabulary to talk about. It's like going back 100 years and asking if people had vocabulary to talk about anxieties and fears that they feel. No. We now have words like phobia and depression and all the other apparatus of self-awareness psychologically, but it took 100 years to develop that capacity to think like that. And Marxism has to develop comparably in order to give people the social vocabulary to deal with it. And that's what Marxian class analysis does. So what differentiates the United States today from what it was 50 years ago? Or today, to differentiate it from Saudi Arabia or Brazil or China, is not the presence or absence of any of these five. They're all present in all countries most of the time. What differentiates them are the relative importance. There are parts of the world where there's a lot more slavery relative to the total population than there is here. There are parts of the world in which the feudal class structure of the traditional family has almost vanished. Whereas in other parts of the world, it's the dominant class structure of the family, and so on. How a society functions depends on which class structures are dominant in people's lives. Not only in their lives on the job in the workplace, but at home. We're going to have occasion in this next several sessions to talk in detail about this. I can't do that now. But we're going to talk about, for example, that Marxian class analysis allows something you perhaps haven't thought of before. If there are multiple class structures in society, then an individual, you, me, him, her, may very well participate in more than one. So that unlike other theories, like the property theory, you're either in the class of the rich or you're not. You're in one or the other. And many of you may think that class analysis requires figuring out where everybody is. For example, in Russia and China, at certain points, they had people pegged. This is a bourgeois. This is a proletariat. You were one or the other. But not in what I've just told you. It's not part of this. Let me give you an example. At home, if you're a man in a traditional family, you are exploiting your wife. She produces a surplus, she does, that you get and distribute. Then you go to your job where someone exploits you. You're operating in two different class structures, one at home and one on the job. This may do a number on your head. It may be very important, for example, to compensate yourself for the indignities of being exploited on the job by sticking it to your serf at home. Uh-oh. What happens then? How does that work? Here's another possibility. Suppose the conditions of exploitation in the home produce, for all kinds of possible reasons, a welling up of women in traditional households who can't stand being exploited anymore. How surprising is that? How different is it from workers who can't stand being exploited on the job? And if those women refuse, and if that takes the form of, I won't have it anymore, I want a different relationship here, I'm not happy, I'm not satisfied, then we have the question, as in a society, what is the exploiter going to do with the rebellion of the exploited? Come to a compromise. That's one option. Repress. That's another option. Dissolve the relationship. Close the factory. Get a divorce. But if you get a divorce because you can't stand it, but you didn't have an analysis that the class structure of the household was part of your problem, then you take the terrible risk that you identify the problem with that asshole husband and you leave him and you go find another asshole and you do it all again because you haven't understood that it wasn't him and his peculiarities, or at least not only that. It's also a situation you can't stand. But you need an analysis that would help you see that. And Americans, the idea that class exists in the household is a new idea. But it shouldn't be. Because Marx said, wherever work is done, the question has to be asked, the Marxist class question. Is there surplus being produced by anybody? And if so, by whom? And if so, who gets the surplus? You have to ask that question. And in a household, labor is done. Production occurs all the time. Child care, cooking meals, cleaning things, repairing things, healing people's wounds, etc., all kinds of work. And if work is done, you have to ask the class question. Is there a surplus being produced? Of course you ask that question. So the implications here are stunning. Now let me end, in the time that remains, by giving you some sense of how and why a class analysis based on the analysis of the surplus and how it's organized in society will lead you to have, as we're going to see in the remainder of this session of classes, different analytical results. And I'm going to pick some examples which we're going to go into in detail. So I hope to tease you and entice you and get you interested because you're going to do it, we're going to do it in detail. So I'm going to give you some with heavy political implications. So let me pick one, the Soviet Union. And I'm going to give you now a stylized version. We're going to do this in detail later. A stylized version. In 1917, a revolt. A revolt of the masses of peasants and workers against hundreds of years of dynastic absolute monarchy. The Tsars, they were called in Russia. And this one, the Tsar is overthrown, the Tsar is killed, and his family is, I mean, it's very dramatic, a revolution that overthrows Tsarist Russia and establishes the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Goes from monarchy to republic, from capitalist and feudal to social. Wow! And what do? Well, they're Marxists. The leaders of this revolution are Marxists. Stalin, Trotsky, Lenin, and all the others are Marxists, steeped in Marxism. Trotsky and Lenin are fantastic writers, major contributors to the Marxist theoretical tradition. So these are Marxists, sophisticated students. They have, however, they have, taken Marx's work and by the way, I don't mean to be a Monday morning quarterback. If I had been them living in their circumstances, I would do exactly what I'm about to describe. But I don't. So I don't think the way they do. Heaven, that's a good thing. It'd be very strange if I did. Coming in at a different time, a different place, so forth. So here's what they did. They saw Marx as a more radical version of the old thinkers in class terms who were concerned about property and power. So what they did is they wanted to overthrow capitalism to radically change the distribution of property and to radically change the distribution of power and to radically change people's consciousness from being a serf or a lord. The old Russian self-identification consciousness, we became all workers and peasants. That's a radical change of how you think of yourself. What did they do to property? Very impressive. They took the property away from the rich, basically. They took it away from the capitalists, and they made it the property of everybody. In the case of industry, it became nationalized or socialized property, and everybody had an equal share. Radical change in the distribution of property. On the countryside, they did something different. For those of you who don't know, you'll learn about that. They took the land away from the bigger landowners, but they gave everybody private property and land. By the way, the notion that the Soviet Union abolished private property is something that can only be said by a person who has no idea what happened. I mean, it's really painful. It's a little bit like you're telling me that Rush Limbaugh is a leader of the American socialist movement. If you say that, I would be upset because it shows you are so far out of it, I wouldn't even know how to begin to talk to you. To tell me that the Soviet Union is the end of private property is a level of ignorance that's painful. I'm embarrassed for you. It's like you forgot your pants today, and here you are in our little group, standing there with nothing, and it's embarrassing. And you're going to notice it in a few minutes, and I can see how it's going to hurt your feelings, and you're going to run off and all the rest. So they gave the land to all the little peasants. That's an equal distribution of property to each peasant. Did power change? Are you kidding? The court of the Tsar is gone. The power of the Russian Orthodox Church, which was enormous, decimated. Power is distributed to Soviets, little groups of workers and peasants, all over. I mean, a dramatic Marxist change in the distribution of property, in the distribution of power, in the consciousness of the people. Dramatic Marxist change. What did they do to the organization of surplus? I'm going to exaggerate, but not by much. Nothing. What do I mean? The day before the revolution, the workers came at 8 o'clock and they stayed until 5. At the end of the day, they left behind what they worked in a Moscow or Leningrad factory. They were paid a wage. They produced more than the wage, the same way my $30 of pens and the $20. And a board of directors of the capitalist corporation that employed them got the difference, got the surplus and distributed. The day after the revolution, they came to work, they did exactly the same thing. They produced a surplus, they didn't get it. Who got it? A group of government officials called commissars, commissioners, Russian word for commissioner, commissar. The state took over, the state took the surplus, and the state distributed it. The workers were no longer exploited by the private owners of the means of production. They were now exploited by the state, the workers' state, the Bolshevik workers' state. Because they're evil? No, no, no. They didn't think in terms of changing the organization of the surplus. They had assimilated Marx's new idea back into the older, much more well-known notions of class about power, property, and consciousness. So they changed what they thought was the class structure, leaving in place the old one. And as the Soviet Union struggled, it never dealt with that problem. And eventually, the conflicts, the bitterness, and the tensions between the mass of exploited workers and the now government exploiters led to an explosion in which they got rid of the public governmental exploitative apparatus and reestablished a private capitalist system of exploitation, to which one can only hang one's head in horrible empathy with the Russian people. Oh my God. The tragedy doubled. And why? Again, to drive the point home, because the analytical framework to follow Marx's argument that you have to change the organization of surplus, that wasn't attended to. It's not because the government forced it on anybody. The mass of people didn't think that way either. They thought they had made the revolution when they changed property, power, and consciousness. What would it have meant in the Soviet Union to deal with class in the Marxian sense? You would have had to dramatically alter how production was organized in the factory, in the office, and in the household. Because if you only change the class structure in the workplace, but you leave an exploitative class structure in the household, what will that do? For example, what does it mean that children are raised in a household where the husband exploits the wife? Nobody says that. Nobody's conscious of that. We love each other. Sure you do. Just the way thousands of masters loved their slaves. And thousands of lords did, genuinely. They didn't see a problem in the coexistence of a love relationship and an exploitative one. And by the way, those two can exist together. Heaven knows. But they can also clash. But the clash will not appear to be that if you don't have the ability to see the issue of the organization of the surplus. In the Soviet Union, it was the end of that system. It could not deal with that issue, and that had something to do with its history. Just like an inability to do this kind of analysis will also make it very difficult, for example, to understand, I will argue later, indeed, next week when we meet, it'll be very difficult to understand the current global capitalist crisis. You're going to see, as we do this next week, how I will use the Marxist analysis of surplus to give you a consistent explanation for how and why global capitalism, led by the United States, ended up in the collapse of the last 3 years. Why did we go from 7 million, the official number of unemployed in December of 2007 in the United States, to 16 million today? A number of unemployed that has risen without interruption to this moment, right now. What is that about? That has to do with the relationship between the producers and appropriators and distributors of the surplus. I'll show you that. And it's not because I figured something out. I just used that framework to analyze the situation. And I'm going to show you the analysis that results from it. And I think you'll find it very persuasive, and you'll certainly find it interesting enough that you'll be kind of pissed that you hadn't already encountered this. That among the other explanations having to do with such profound insights as people were greedy, or people were dishonest, or people didn't properly supervise, we didn't have the right regulation. Deep analysis, this is not. So I think I'll show you that even if you're not persuaded by what I do, you'll see there's a remarkable way to explain and analyze not only the crisis as it emerges, but the crisis as it plays itself out now, and the extraordinary absence of a government program to deal with this. So I think you will be able to see that in the case of the Soviet Union, which we will return to, in the case of the crisis of the United States, which we will deal with next week, that Marxian class analysis is an immense, complex, sophisticated, rich way of understanding the society, and that there is something verging, on the criminal, that you haven't been introduced to it, that it hasn't been presented to you, that you haven't been taught it enough that you can use it, and then make up your own mind whether the analytical understandings you get are satisfactory or not, the way you would with another theory. You live in a society which is afraid of doing that. And not the least importance of an institution like the Brecht Forum is that it wants to offset, correct, and remedy that defect in this culture. I personally think you will also get from Marxian class analysis a way to begin to understand not only why the events of your life are happening, and I mean that in your personal life as well as your larger citizenship roles, but I think you will get major help in beginning to answer the question, what can I do about it? Do I only have to be a passive observer of all of this, or are there ways that people who see these things can begin to intervene and make the history change from what it otherwise would have been? And if I could conclude, I would say, if you're self-conscious, then informing yourself and learning about Marxian class analysis is a necessary step to having an adult developed framework for being a productive citizen of this culture. It is not a virtue of this culture of the United States, and I've spent all my adult life in the American university system, that's what I do. It is not a virtue that this is unknown. It is a sign of immaturity, fear, and hysteria that this elaborated system with so much to offer is unavailable for the vast majority of people. So California Republican communists will remain unaware of what they have done, unaware of its implications. That's bad enough. But the American left, which ought to build off of those experiments and teach what they imply, that those people walked away from capitalism because it was unsatisfactory and unhappy and made them unproductive, so they could go to a communist enterprise where they are much happier and much more productive. Little clue. Many of the most important technical breakthroughs of modern telecommunications and computers were achieved in these little communal enterprises. They are testimony to the productivity of the communist organization of production. But they are regularly trumpeted all over the world as great fruits of modern American capitalism. What a hustle. Last point for today, because we've run out of time. One of the items on the reading list, by the way, you can get the reading list off of the website of the Brecht Forum. Just go there to the under my class. The whole reading list is there. Print it off your computer. Almost all the readings, you just click on the thing that you get, the electronic form, and it'll take you right to the reading. Most of those readings are writings that I have done or people close to me have done that are on my website. rdwolf.com, all of that stuff is there, plus a lot of other stuff that you might find interesting. There is a book which is on the reading list, which is this book here, that I wrote, that just released a month ago, called Capitalism Hits the Fan. You should, I hope, enjoy the title. And many of the arguments we're going to deal with next week about the crisis and how to use a Marxian analysis are in this book. I have it here. It's $20 a copy. It's what it's cost from the publisher. You can also get it through my website. Then it'll go to Amazon. You get it through that. But if you want to buy it now or next week, I will have copies here. Other than that, I will meet you next week. Take a look at the readings. And we will all gather here at 5:30 next Tuesday. And thank you for braving the weather. See you next week.